All right, we welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our docket this afternoon. We will hear the first case, then we'll take a recess because we do have a change of panel. If the clerk will please announce counsel who will be arguing today. Thank you. All right, and you all are aware that you have asked for and received a little bit of additional time, so it'll be 23 minutes for each side and then an 8-minute rebuttal. And I would make one special request because of the fact that we have three different appeals here. As you approach your issues, please identify which appeal, if it's limited to one particular appeal, which one you're talking about. That's probably more relevant to the appellant here. All right, let's proceed. Mr. Campbell.
May it please the court. Plaintiff would like to cover several points in our argument today. I will flip down our agenda. It's a little bit ambitious. We may not get to all of them, but we'll try to cover the important points first. First is that the AG has no standing and the courts below have no subject matter jurisdiction to sue plaintiff appellant Jerry Stansberry to remove him as the independent executor and trustee for alleged misapplication or embezzlement of estate and trust property and or gross mismanagement or misconduct concerning his duties as executor and trustee pursuant to Texas Probate Code Section 149C and the definitional Section 3R. That has to do with really all of the appeals, we believe. The second point is the AG lacks standing to sue under the Texas Constitution and the statutes, and the AG's limited powers thereunder are not expanded by the vague penumbras of common law. The third point is plaintiff would like to respond to the AG's flawed reasoning that the AG represents only the, quote, interests of the general public in charitable trust, close quote, in this litigation. Fourth, the AG is bound by the co-trustee's mutual release of plaintiff under the doctrine of virtual representation. No exceptions have been pleaded or proven by the Attorney General. Fifth, plaintiffs would like to counter the AG's floodgates argument, that is, if the mutual release in this case is binding on the AG, then all charitable trustees in Texas forevermore could just execute mutual releases and the AG could never sue a truly defalcating charitable trustee. That's wrong. We'll explain why. Sixth, in the district court, now this is the number of 55, declaratory judgment cause of action against the AG, sovereign immunity from suit does not apply, and the AG is a, quote, proper party, close quote, for at least four reasons, which we'll tick down. Seventh, the county court's temporary injunction and amended temporary injunctions are all void, must be reversed and dissolved. And then finally, we have a short closing argument and a request for relief. So, starting with argument one, point one, the AG has no standing and the courts below have no subject matter jurisdiction to sue plaintiff to remove him as the independent executor and trustee for these alleged wrongdoings. There are several reasons for that. First, the AG does not and cannot meet the definition of an interested person under Probate Code Section 3R and the case law thereunder, including cases from this court. But even if the AG is an interested person, he can only constitute such an interested person through the definitional language of a devisee or heir of this estate, and therefore the AG must be bound by the mutual release through the doctrine of virtual representation. I'd like to start briefly with a review of the A&W Industries case. That was a Justice Livingston case, 1998, from this court. A&W Industries, in that case, contracted with the co-executors of a decedent's estate to purchase assets of the estate from the estate. Co-executors sued A&W to rescind the contract. A&W counterclaimed for specific performance, and then A&W filed a motion to remove the executors for, quote, gross misconduct or gross mismanagement of the estate and because the executors allegedly misapplied estate property, the same claims that the AG is making in this case. This Fort Worth court identified the issue to be decided, as whether a contract claim against the estate qualifies as an interested person, a contract claimant. The court observed the paucity of evidence offered by A&W when the motion in limine challenging their standing was heard. This court noted that virtually no evidence was offered by A&W and held that A&W had not met its burden to prove standing, and A&W's motion to remove the executors was dismissed. This court relied on the very stringent definition of an interested person laid down by the Supreme Court in the Logan v. Thomason case, 202 Southwest 2nd 212, Texas Supreme Court, 1947. There was an extended discussion of interested person in that case, and the Supreme Court held that the contestant, in this case the AG's interest, must be a pecuniary interest held by that movement as an individual or in a representative capacity, such as a trustee, and that pecuniary interest must be affected by the probate of the will or the administration of the estate. The AG has not pled or proven in this case that he holds a pecuniary interest in this estate, either for himself or as a trustee for anyone else, including the eventual charitable beneficiaries of this testamentary trust. The next relevant case is, again, this court's case, 1992, Maurer v. Sayer, 833 Southwest 2nd 680. This court defined a pecuniary interest affected by the will or the estate as it was defined in Logan. And Logan's language was cited specifically. An interested person has a restricted meaning, much more constricted than mere standing in the normal course. It must be a pecuniary interest, and that pecuniary interest must be held by the contestant in that case. And the court held that in that case, the contestant did have such a pecuniary interest because he stood to lose $900,000 personally if he was not allowed to contest the will. Then we come to the estate of York. We contend that's a very important case. The AG places great reliance on that case. This case involved the specific question as to whether the AG could constitute an interested person under Section 3R of the Probate Code. That court defined that issue as the key issue and then said more clearly that issue is whether the York estate involves the present Myrtle York Charitable Trust, not some vague interest of the general public, whether the York estate involves the present Myrtle York Charitable Trust such that the AG may intervene on its behalf. On behalf of that specific testamentary trust, not some vague general public interest. In that case, the AG was honest enough with the court to admit that it was intervening on behalf of that specific charitable testamentary trust and not to allege that the AG was merely representing the interests of the general public. The court proceeded to analyze the AG's standing under the definitional language of Section 3R. And it quoted the Supreme Court's Logan test and the standard of a pecuniary interest that had to be affected by the probate proceeding. And it noted that interested persons includes devisees and beneficiaries of the estate. The court then held, in that case, the AG had the right to assert this trust's claims regarding that estate, which were otherwise left unprotected in that case. Because the court had stricken the executor, dismissed his defense of the trust, and there was no one else left in that case to defend the charitable trust. Therefore, the court specifically held that the AG's petition represented an intervention sought by an heir. The court equated the AG with an heir in that case, and therefore held that 3R's definition could be met by the AG in that case. In fact, in footnote 4 in that case, the court said, since this court has already remanded to the trial court for joinder of the executor, it may ultimately turn out that the AG has no standing to assert the rights of this trust as an heir, while the executor of the estate remains able to represent those interests. However, the question placed before us in this appeal is only whether the AG has the right to intervene in this estate proceeding in the absence of any other party to protect the interests of the charitable trust. There's only two conclusions that can be drawn here from the York case. One is that the only pecuniary interest that the AG in this case can possibly represent is the pecuniary interest of the Stansberry Charitable Testamentary Trust in this case as an heir of this estate, not some vague, amorphous, non-pecuniary interest of the general public. And since the AG can only claim to represent this charitable trust as an heir in this estate, the AG is bound by the doctrine of virtual representation through the mutual releases signed by the co-trustees while they were still co-trustees.
Before you go on to that, can you tell me then what is the interplay between the property code provision that really describes the AG as a proper party and gives specific authority for the Attorney General to intervene in a suit that names a charitable trust as a beneficiary?
Yes, ma'am. In the live pleadings, not in their brief, in their live pleadings before the county court, the AG has pled alternatively they have standing as an interested person, I've just covered that, or they have standing under Chapter 123 to represent the interests of the general public. I think it's pretty clear if they're claiming under interested person, then they're bound by the doctrine of virtual representation because they can only represent an heir. With respect to the argument that Chapter 123 gives the AG standing to, under the trust code, there are a number of responses to that. The first is, in essence, we've got three Texas Supreme Court cases that say, in this situation, the AG doesn't have that authority anymore after the mutual release was signed. First and seminal case is the Rice University case, 1966, Texas Supreme Court. And in analyzing that case, I would like to point out to the court, first of all, that the decedent's will in this case, Section Roman 7E, specifically authorizes these trustees, not the AG, these trustees to settle litigation and claims with reference to this testamentary trust. Specifically, the trustees have the authority to settle and release any claims in favor of or against the trust estate. Now, what did the Supreme Court say in Rice? In Rice, the AG was a named party. He was sued by the Rice trustees under the old Article 4412A, the predecessor to Chapter 123 in the trust code now. And even with that stronger article in place, which said the AG was a necessary party in charitable trust litigation and had to be joined, even with that statute in place, the court still held that the trustees and the beneficiaries of the charitable trust had standing to carry forward the judicial proceedings concerning the charitable trust terms when the AG elected not to participate. This is our exact situation in this case, Your Honors, as we've briefed ad nauseum in our statement of facts. What we have here in this case is 6 months of the AG doing virtually nothing substantive in this case, despite four letters from me importuning the AG to meet with us, review evidence, conduct settlement negotiations, ignored. Then, when we finally had to serve the AG with the petition in this case, that was done. The petition was filed on August 5, 2011. The AG was served the same day. We had 3 months of inactivity by the AG in this case. The AG would not take a position, would do nothing. So we proceeded with settlement negotiations with the other co-trustees who were named in the litigation and were participating. And for after 3 months of inactivity on the part of the AG, we settled the case with those two other co-trustees. So the Supreme Court was very clear on the Rice University case. If the AG wants to sit on the sideline and, in essence, do nothing for a period of time, then the real parties in interest, the named trustees, and the charitable beneficiaries have the right to go forward with the litigation without the joinder of the AG. In fact, the AG's own brief in the Supreme Court Rice case judicially admitted that the common law of Texas before the 1959 enactment of Article 4412A permitted other parties to the charitable trust litigation to prosecute that litigation without any participation by the AG at all. And the intent of the legislature in enacting Article 4412A was not to alter that aspect of the prior common law. The AG admitted that in the Rice case. The Supreme Court held that Article 4412A does not preclude other parties from the trial or appeal of such cases. It does not require the AG to file an answer or to conduct the litigation. And it does not say that the AG is the preclusive party or the only party who may carry forward that litigation. All right. Now let's go to the other line of Supreme Court cases. Garcia v. Laughlin, Texas Supreme Court, 1955. Question in that case specifically was, what litigation power does the AG have to sue to remove a county official? That was the issue. And the Supreme Court analyzed the Texas Constitution, Article 44, Section 12, said it defines the duties and powers of an AG in litigation specifically, and held that the powers conferred by the Constitution on state officials are exclusive, and those powers cannot be enlarged except in the manner authorized by the Constitution. They can't even be enlarged by a court. The powers and duties of the AG are prescribed by the Constitution and statutes and must be so limited and may not be enlarged by the courts. It's a direct quote from the Garcia Court. And in that case, because there was no constitutional or statutory provision vesting the AG with power to institute that litigation to remove that county officer, the AG had no standing to bring that case. The situation is that was confirmed in the Southwestern Bell Telephone case, Texas Supreme Court, 1975, which held that the AG did have litigation authority in that case to sue Southwestern Bell because the specific language in the Constitution said the AG has a power to bring litigation against private companies regarding collecting any species of taxes or tolls not authorized by law, and Southwestern Bell was trying to extract a toll charge for its long-distance charges. So the AG had the authority in that case. Now, that brings us to the current Trust Code section, Chapter 123. And what specific powers does it give the AG? Specifically, it says, this is Section 123.002, the AG is a proper party in a proceeding involving a charitable trust. Section 123.003 then says a party initiating a proceeding involving a charitable trust, which my plaintiff did, must give statutory notice to the AG of that action, which he did on the day that he filed his petition. And then, most importantly, Section 123.004B, a compromise settlement agreement contract, such as a release or judgment relating to a proceeding involving a charitable trust, is voidable on motion of the AG if the AG has not received the statutory notice. The AG has received the statutory notice. He doesn't have that power. That's what Garcia says. If the power is not expressly given to the AG in the Constitution or an express statute, then the AG doesn't have that power. We did serve the AG with a Chapter 123 notice on the same day we filed the petition in district court. The AG has no power to void or avoid the mutual release under Chapter 123 and its preclusive effect because we did serve the notice. If we serve the notice, he doesn't have that right. That's what the statute says. That's what Garcia says. Next, we would like to respond to the AG's flawed reasoning that the AG represents only the interests of the general public in charitable trust in this specific litigation. First of all, we want to point out, as I've just mentioned, that's not what the AG's live pleadings say in the courts below. In the county court, the live pleadings assert, alternatively, that the AG is an interested person under the probate code section 3R and 149C, so that he has allegedly standing to remove the executor and the trustee, or he has standing under Chapter 123, which I've just been through. Okay, the AG's flawed reasoning that he represents, he says in his briefs now to this court, only the interests of the general public. If that's true, if the court's going to hold the AG to that representation, then under A&W Industries, under Logan, and under the estate of York, which I've just been through, the AG has no standing to remove the plaintiff as an independent executor or trustee because he has to have a pecuniary interest in this specific estate and he has to represent this specific testamentary charitable trust. If he just represents the vague, ambiguous general interests of the general public, that's not enough to be an interested person under Code Section 149C and 3R. So then you're thrown into Chapter 123. What if the AG represents only the interests of the general public in charitable trust under Chapter 123, then what is the result there? I've just been through what is the result there. He doesn't have the statutory authority and power to void the mutual release and the settlement because he doesn't meet the statutory requirements, because we gave the notice and he did nothing. In that situation, the AG doesn't even have standing to represent, well, he has standing to represent the interests of the general public, but it won't get him anywhere in this case because he is foreclosed by the mutual release. We would point out for the court that the Chapter 123, when it was enacted in 1987, dropped the prior statute's reference about this clarifies questions in the common law and otherwise maintains a prior law, common law. That was not asserted or repeated in Chapter 123. There is no such reference in Chapter 123 now. We would also point out for the court, if the mutual release is not otherwise binding on the AG, then why even put into the current statute the power of the AG to void settlements and releases? The only reason to give the AG power to void them in certain limited circumstances is if they will otherwise would be binding on the AG, and they are. I see I've got limited time here. I don't want to overlook this, but we would direct the court's attention to our briefing on the fact that the AG is bound by the mutual release under the doctrine of virtual representation. No exceptions have been pleaded or proven by the AG. I would point out that this court was very emphatic in both the Armstrong case, which we cited, and the A&W Industries case, which we cited. When there is a plea to the jurisdiction and a challenge to the standing of the other party, in this case the AG, at that hearing the burden is on the AG to come forward and present all of his evidence to prove up his standing and his interested person status. No evidence was submitted at that hearing by the AG to prove up his standing. And we've already been through the York analysis that the AG can only represent the testamentary trust, and that is equivalent to an heir of the estate or a beneficiary of the trust. The beneficiaries and the heirs are bound by the litigation strategy and settlements entered into either by the executor or by the trustees. We've cited a number of cases. I would like to point out, I'm about to have to stop. I would just point the court to the York case, the Weatherly Trust case, the Cogdell case, and the Armstrong cases for the proposition that the AG is bound by the settlement and the mutual release in this case entered into by the executor and the co-trustees under the doctrine of virtual representation. And that's the law, and he's pled and proven no exceptions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Ms. Morales?
May it please the court, counsel. Let me start out by saying we don't represent the trust or the beneficiaries, and the trustees don't represent us. Charitable trusts are different from private trusts because they provide a public good. And accordingly, we the public have a stake and an interest in their proper administration. Malfeasance or nonfeasance related to a charitable trust hurts the public interest in charity. And the Attorney General is the protector of that public interest in charity and has not only the right but the duty to protect that public interest in charity. And the Supreme Court has been very emphatic about that and has recognized the Attorney General's position as the protector of the public interest in charity since at least 1942. The Texas courts have recognized that since 1929. And specifically, I'd like to point the court to some language in the Powers Court in which it was argued that the Attorney General could not intervene. And a commission sitting for the Supreme Court at that time said, to argue that the Attorney General could not intervene in this case to enforce the trust in the event of misfeasance or nonfeasance of the trustee is but to beg the question. Such right of intervention necessarily attaches to any public charity trust to preserve and protect the same for the very sufficient reason that it serves a public purpose and therefore is accorded public protection, which the law affords by suit that filed by the public law enforcement officer, the Attorney General. And the court went on to say that in the case of a charitable trust, it is not only his right but his duty to sue and to protect and enforce it wherever proper or necessary.
Does it matter that the trust or the charitable trust itself has yet to be funded? In other words, I think one of the arguments appellant makes is that the entity itself doesn't exist, so maybe this trust code provision doesn't apply yet, and we're constrained by the probate code provisions.
Your Honor, I think there are two reasons why that's not the case. The first is, as recognized by the Powers Court and by the Boyd Court and the Loki Court, the Attorney General has a duty to represent the public interest in charity as it relates to charitable trusts and has recognized the authority of the Attorney General to become involved and intervene even in whatever form or fashion the case may require. But in addition to that, in Chapter 23, specifically in the definition of charitable trusts, the legislature has provided a very expansive definition. And specifically, .1003, in the definition of a proceeding involving a charitable trust, it includes a suit or other judicial proceeding, the object of which is to determine matters relating to the probate and administration of an estate involving a charitable trust. So the legislature has already included that kind of proceeding as the type of proceeding in which the Attorney General is a proper party. In addition to the expansive recognition of the Attorney General's authority and responsibility by the courts. I do want to point out that the Supreme Court has differentiated between the public interest in a charitable trust and a private interest in a charitable trust. And that, in fact, is what the Rice case is about. What happened in Rice was that the university sought to remove some restrictions that were placed placed on the trust that went to Rice, and the Attorney General was a party to that, as was required. And then some students and alumni intervened, two different sets, one on each side. And the Attorney General did not block the intervention of either party. The Attorney General remained involved in the lawsuit, but it sort of stayed neutral at the time. When it came time to appeal, the Attorney General chose not to appeal, but one of the groups of students chose to appeal. And the question on appeal was, do they have a right to continue this appeal? And in its discussion, the Supreme Court segregated out the right of the Attorney General to represent the public interest in charity and the right of individuals who might have their own private interest. And where a party has a private interest, for example, a beneficiary might have a private interest in a trust, those parties are not precluded from bringing a suit to protect their own private interests. And that's all that the Rice case stands for, that a private interest can be brought by an individual as a private interest, separate and apart and distinct from the public interest. It does not mean that a person who has a private interest and brings a private interest lawsuit somehow precludes the Attorney General from bringing its own suit or intervening or bringing some sort of action on behalf of the public interest. I also want to touch on briefly the whole question about the 3R definition. It's the Attorney General's position that the Attorney General, both by common law and through Chapter 123, has the right and authority and obligation to become involved in litigation or to bring a suit if necessary to protect the public interest in charity. And that authority is broader than simply that provided in the interested party provision of 149C. However, we certainly disagree with the characterization by Mr. Stansberry that should the Attorney General fit under that definition, that the Attorney General fits in only as a devisee and is somehow then represented by the trustees. The language of 3R is broader than simply devisees. It includes a language that states a person who has a claim against the estate, for example, which our position would be the Attorney General could very well have a claim against the estate on behalf of the public interest in charity to ensure that a trust is properly funded. And this is recognized by the section of 123.001, the definition that I quoted to you earlier, as far as the definition of what a charitable, a proceeding involving a charitable trust is. We certainly recognize that the only authority out there who's really looked at this question has been the State of York. We disagree with the way that the Corpus Christi courts characterized the Attorney General's involvement and position, because it is counter to that recognized by the Texas Supreme Court in Powers and in Loki and in Boyd, which is that the Attorney General represents the public interest in charity. However, we do agree with the overall holding that the Attorney General is an interested party under 3R. And I also want to point out that in terms of the otherwise left unprotected argument, Mr. Stansberry's counsel suggests that in this case, that the 3R only applies to the Attorney General if the trust is otherwise left unprotected. When you have a situation where the trustees are not fulfilling their duty, then you have a situation where a trust is being left unprotected. And in fact, that's sort of the whole genesis of why the Attorney General has this responsibility to represent the public interest. Because if you have a fox guarding the hen house, none of the hens are going to be safe. If you have malfeasance or nonfeasance by trustees, and if trustees are the only ones who are supposed to be representing and protecting the trust, then there's no one to look out for the public interest in charity as to the good that's supposed to flow from that trust to the public. It's for this reason the Supreme Court has recognized the Attorney General's duty as the public interest protector of the public interest in charity to bring litigation if necessary to protect that interest. I also want to touch on the mutual release and virtual representation arguments. As this court knows, virtual representation arises out of an equitable legal theory that parties who are not represented in the litigation below, they were not named parties below, may nevertheless bring an appeal if they were virtually represented by a party that was in the litigation. This theory has no application to this case on a number of levels. The first and most obvious one is we were parties. We were parties to the litigation below. We have our own representation, and the trustees' actions as to the interests that they have bound them but did not bind us. Moreover, as I mentioned, it's an equitable theory dealing with the ability to bring an appeal. We can bring appeal or if we needed to because we were parties below. It simply has no applicability to this case. Likewise, we're not bound by the mutual release by the trustees because we are not in privity with them. The cases which appellant has cited dealing with beneficiaries being bound by the trustees arise out of the fact that trustees have a fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries. There is that legal relationship with them that causes the beneficiaries to be bound by the trustees. We do not have that legal relationship with the trustees. Our job is to protect the public interest in charity, regardless of what the trustees do. In fact, specifically if the trustees are failing on their responsibility, that's when we're supposed to step in. And that actually leads me to the language of 123.004, which counsel has argued limits the Attorney General's authority. And I'd like to talk a little bit about where that change in language came from. Prior to the enactment of that statute and 123 in general, the Attorney General was a mandatory party to all litigation involving a charitable trust, and no settlements could be entered into without the Attorney General's involvement. Otherwise, they were void. Well, this led to, you can imagine the number of cases that would then be subject to being voided out because of that. The current version of that statute, 123.004, allows the Attorney General the opportunity to make a determination whether it wants to be a party or not, whether it needs to be a party. The Attorney General does not need to be a party to every single action involving a charitable trust if there is no danger to the public interest in charity in that particular litigation. Where there is, the Attorney General will intervene, or if the Attorney General has received some sort of complaint, the Attorney General has a mandatory duty to look into that, and if necessary, to sue to protect the public interest of charity, a duty which is specifically recognized by 123.005, which talks about the Attorney General bringing a suit to allege a breach of fiduciary duty. So all that the change to 123.004 did was to allow the Attorney General the option not to get involved in a suit. And in the cases where the Attorney General has not been given that opportunity because they didn't get notice, then the law protects the Attorney General's authority to void a settlement. But in a case where they have been given notice, then obviously they're parties. They have the option to become parties if they choose. And if the Attorney General chooses to become a party, then they will already be involved in the litigation. If they choose not to become a party, they sign a waiver of their participation, which the statute refers to, then the parties can proceed on to a settlement without the Attorney General being involved.
And at the time of the mutual release, the AG was already in the lawsuit, I guess it was the district court case where the mutual release came out of. Is that correct?
The mutual release came out of the district court case. The Attorney General had been named as a party, but it had not yet been served. But it had been specifically named as a party in that suit.
Ms. Garcia, how can you say when you start that you do not represent the trust and you do not represent the trustees, but yet under the terms of the trust, the only way that the public benefits is through the language that's in the trust? How can you not be involved in representing the trust if you're attempting to enforce the terms for the benefit of the public?
Your Honor, the last portion of your statement.
That was meant to be a question.
The last portion of that question, Your Honor, is where I'll start. We represent the public interest in charity. We do not represent the trust. And here's the way that I sort of distinguish that. The law provides that the trust has its own representatives, which are the trustees. They are bound by their fiduciary duty to represent the trust, to represent the beneficiaries. Where they fail in their obligations, that is where the Attorney General can step in. We do not have the duty to represent every single trust in this state and oversee all the obligations that a trustee would. That is their legal obligation. We represent the public interest in charity, which is a distinct matter and sometimes may be distinct from what even the trustees or the beneficiaries may want if there's some malfeasance or nonfeasance that's going on there. And so we have a broader interest than that. One analogy that came to mind when I was trying to sort this out for myself, and it's not perhaps the best analogy, but perhaps a little helpful. In criminal matters, a district attorney's office seeks justice for the public, not for the individual victim. The individual victim may have their own counsel and may have their own interests, but the district attorney's duty is to the public. And for this reason, a district attorney may bring, for example, take a case to prosecution, even if the victim has chosen not to do so. Another imperfect analogy would be in the family law context, where you have an ad litem appointed to represent a child in a SAPSR proceeding. The ad litem is a party, has a right to bring motions and actions on behalf of the child, because the general interest here is as to the child, but they are separate and apart from the parties. And so the Attorney General represents a broader interest than just representing the trust.
Well, I follow your logic in those areas of the cases you mentioned, but let's talk about specifically the question of a charitable interest, not the interest you're talking about, which are different and distinct from just merely saying the charge is to represent the charitable interest which gets you to the public involvement. And I'm sure there are many thousands, if not millions, of wills in the state of Texas that have a portion of the will that might make some grant to a charitable institution of some type, a college, a hospital, merely just some other entity that has in its purpose providing some good or something that the person that's the maker of the will thought was a good thing. And if the York case seems to try to narrow down and keep the responsibility for looking at trust in probate court and looking at trust in the direct administration of those estates in the court system. And I perceive your discussion and your argument as saying that on top of all of that sits the Attorney General over here with the ability to, upon complaint, instigate an investigation, make factual determinations that might otherwise be left to other fact-determining parties in the judicial system, and then to intervene to take action in those proceedings. Now, am I wrong in what I'm hearing? I mean, did you hear what I said, and do you see the question of logic that I'm trying to get to?
I think so, Your Honor, and I will attempt to respond to that briefly. The Attorney General certainly, upon complaint, reviews those complaints and investigates and sees whether or not it needs to intervene in a proceeding, whether it be at the probate level or whether it be in a lawsuit involving a charitable trust, both of which are under the definition of a proceeding involving charitable trust in Chapter 123. Legislature has provided us the authority to step into both of those situations. I will say, in terms of making determinations, the only determinations made by the Attorney General are, do we feel that there is a possible violation that we need to, that's causing us to intervene? The actual determination as to whether there has been any malfeasance or nonfeasance is going to be determined by the trial court. We simply bring the action to the trial court for the trial court's determination.
On behalf of the state of Texas.
On behalf of the public
interest. With the power of the Attorney General's Office of the state of Texas becoming a party to the private litigation.
Yes, Your Honor, as provided by the state legislature in Chapter 123.
I don't read the... Okay, I understand your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have a limited amount of time. I simply want to, at this point, touch on the two other areas, since I'm not sure if they'll be touched on in the rebuttal. The Attorney General's position regarding the plea to the jurisdiction in the district court is that was properly granted because the Attorney General is protected by sovereign immunity, and that's been covered in the SIR reply brief. And as far as the temporary injunction, as also covered in the SIR reply, we are now dealing with a second amended temporary injunction, and it's our position that it was properly amended, so there is no longer any date issue. The failure of the clerk to actually issue the writ does not invalidate the trial court's decision, and it's our position there is sufficient evidence in the trial court properly granted the second amended temporary injunction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morales. Mr. Campbell, rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am. Let me take those in reverse order. Let me deal first with this allegation that the sovereign immunity protects the AG in this case. There are four reasons it doesn't. I'll tick down them very quickly. Let's start with the one that I haven't briefed yet. But I have read the language from Section 123.002, which specifically says the AG is a, quote, proper party, close quote, in trust litigation. Then you jump over to Texas Rule of Civil Procedure number 37, which specifically says, up till the time that a case goes to the jury, a proper party may be joined in the litigation, period. End of discussion. The Code Construction Act and the case law under it all say the legislature is presumed to know the state of the law and the rules when it enacts a new provision. The new provision is Chapter 123, enacted in 1987. Rule 37 was on the books since the early 40s. The legislature had to know that when it called the AG a proper party in trust litigation, it could be joined by the plaintiff under Rule 37. That's one. Two, Declaratory Judgment Act, Section 37.006A specifically says that in a declaratory judgment suit, any party, any person or entity claiming an interest in the subject matter has to be joined. The AG has claimed that he is a, quote, interested person, close quote, in the subject matter of this estate and this trust. He has judicially admitted that he has an interest in this case. Therefore, sovereign immunity, if it ever applied, has been waived by that provision. The Leeper Court, the Texas Supreme Court, came from this court, the Leeper case. The University of North Texas case also came from this court, specifically declare that in a declaratory judgment action, if the gravamen of the suit is not to obtain money damages against the state agency, but to get declaratory relief specifically involving the construction and application of state statutes to the plaintiff who is filing the DJ action, then sovereign immunity is waived and it doesn't apply. We have pled that specifically in this case. Mr. Stansberry has asked you to look at Trust Code Section 113.053E and Probate Code Section 27 and 352C, and as applied to Mr. Stansberry in this case, hold that he did not violate those statutes. That's exactly what was at issue in the Leeper case, and exactly what this court and the court of, and the Supreme Court said was okay. All right, now let me get to in terms of the amended temporary injunctions, please read the second amended temporary injunction or the nunc-pro-tunc version of the second amended temporary injunction. It still suffers from all the deficiencies that we identified with the first TI, and especially and particularly the final TI is addressed to the wrong juridical party. It enjoins Mr. Stansberry individually. It doesn't enjoin him as executor or trustee, but the whole text of the rest of the seven-page temporary injunction go to trustee actions and executor actions. I exhaustively briefed in the appeal number 55 issue about the different juridical entities and persons between Mr. Stansberry individually and Mr. Stansberry as an executor and trustee. They are not the same. No order directed to an individual can bind that same individual serving as an executor or trustee. The second amended temporary injunction is fatally defective and should be rejected. Now, let me get to the pure rebuttal. The AG's attorney offered the definition of Probate Code Section 3R. Let's look at the definition of Probate Code Section 3R. An interested person means heirs, devisees, spouses, creditors, any others having a property right in or claim against the estate, underline against. The AG has not sued the estate. The AG has sued on behalf of the estate and on behalf of the trust. So he can't shoehorn himself into a claim against the estate. He hasn't sued the estate. He sued on behalf of the estate. And that doesn't even touch the Texas Supreme Court and this court's rulings on pecuniary interest. To be an interested person, you have to have a pecuniary interest. Now, interestingly, we heard some allegations about, well, when the co-trustees fail in their duties, then it's the obligation of the AG to step in and represent the trust, rather, represent the general public. There has been no pleading and no proof by the AG at the trial court stages of any defalcation or failure in their duties on the part of these settling co-trustees. None. That only arose by allegation in the briefs to this court. The A&W case, this court in the A&W case, said when the limine motion is up, challenging the AG's standing, he's got to come forward with pleadings and proof as to why he has standing as an and is an interested person. There was no pleading that these co-trustees defalcated in their duties. There was no proof that these co-trustees defalcated in their duties. And there's still no proof. There's just this vague allegation that because in the exercise of their good judgment, they settled with Mr. Stansberry, which would have cut off about $300,000 worth of attorney's fees, that somehow that's a defalcation of their duties. No pleading and no evidence.
I had a question about that. Under your position, at what point does the AG have a burden to come forward with proof that there's not only a defalcation, but that it injures or impairs the rights of the public or the rights of the ultimate beneficiaries in the charitable trust, as opposed to merely some other maybe devisee or private heir? Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am. And this court has answered that question in the A&W case. And the answer is, when, in my situation, my client files a plea to the jurisdiction and challenges the standing of the AG, that's when that hearing takes place. That's when the AG has to step forward with a pleading and proof of the defalcation of those co-trustees. There was no pleading and no proof when my plea to the jurisdiction was heard before the county court. None.
That would be governed by the same sort of jurisdictional procedural rules as a typical plea to the jurisdiction, where if there's evidence brought forward, some evidence, but it creates a fact issue only, then it goes back for trial.
No, ma'am. We would contend that because the AG contended that he was an interested person, that's governed by the A&W case, Section 149C, and the it's called a limine hearing, but it's actually a plea to the jurisdiction or a standing hearing. That's when all that evidence and those pleadings have to be presented, not later on, and it's not a question of a fact issue being decided later on. It's decided in that hearing. Interestingly, also, the Cogdell case says, if the AG feels like the co-trustees defalcated in their duty in signing this mutual release in the settlement agreement, the proper relief is for the AG to sue those trustees. That's the only relief. The release totally exculpates my client, and he cannot be sued any further. Then we heard an exposition about virtual representation with respect to the appeals theory. We're not claiming virtual representation with respect to the appeals theory. That is, who can appeal the case. We're claiming it under the trust law definition of virtual representation, which I've already been through, but basically is beneficiaries or those taking under the trustee or the executor are bound by the litigation actions, including settlement agreements and releases, by the trustee and by the executor. That's what we're relying on. There was no response to that. I would also point out, the AG was served with notice of our district court petition on the day that it was filed, August 5, 2010. The AG was served formally with citation on October 28, 2010. The mutual release and the dismissal by the court, district court, was not until November 1, 2010. AG had 6 months to investigate this case, 3 months after the case was filed, and the AG did nothing. Okay, I think Justice Meyer is right on in his questions about what about this general public? Can't they only have an interest through the trust itself? The answer is yes. The general public can only have a pecuniary interest in this trust if a specific member of the general public eventually becomes a charitable beneficiary of this trust. So we agree with that. Then very briefly in conclusion, Your Honors, I would point out the following. We have some important public policies at issue in this case. The interest of the AG and the general public in charitable trust in Texas is a significant interest. We agree with that. But that interest pales in comparison to the much broader, more pronounced, and more frequently invoked interest of the general public in, quote, encouraging peaceable resolutions of disputes and early settlements of pending litigation through voluntary settlement procedures, end quote. That's the Avery case that I cited in our brief. And the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, this court, has held that it is the responsibility of the courts to carry out that important public policy. In fact, in your University of North Texas case, last year, you said, we encourage parties to settle their disagreements whenever possible. So we contend that the public policy favoring early settlement should prevail, especially because it is much more prevalent in Texas than the very occasional public policy involving a charitable trust. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Thank you, Ms. Morales. We appreciate all of your briefing in this case. I know it was somewhat burdensome since we did consolidate all three appeals. We also appreciate your coming here today to present your oral arguments. Your case is now submitted and you all are dismissed. We will recess for 10 minutes and take up case number 2 on our docket, which is Ross v. State.
Thank you, Justice.